Hey there, this is your old buddy Tom, the Toonami Operations Module. Settle in, it's about to get good. Toonami's back, bitches.
Took you long enough.
This has been an experience we will never forget.
This ain't no time to go all mushy.
Don't lecture me, I've waited long enough.
As I gaze upon the beautiful abyss of outer space, I can't help but reminisce on how we held on to our faith. Gold is how we stayed till the day that time would say that Toonami's back, bitches. Pardon my francais. Now every week the absolution blasts off while the masses watch as an old familiar mascot by the name of Tom takes a seat and kicks the broadcast off, making major moves like a triple cut backdrop. I still remember watching Nebion doing damage and thinking, damn, is Goku ever gonna reach Namek? Obviously, I got a lot of love for the classics. The speed at which I used to run home to watch was the fastest. Absolution moving, flying through the galaxy. Toonami's back with a slap in the face to those who doubted it. Remain Toonami faithful till the day that I am graying old. And like a Super Saiyan's glow, I will always stay gold.
This is Nerdcore Absolution. Come to peace with your inner nerd, and after you can stay gold like T.O.M. Chilling out the galaxy, and we know him.
Watching closely from a perch among the stars, as viewers await the moment when the spirit bomb can charge. Hito, you, we self.
Hey there, my Toonami generation, and welcome to a brand new episode of Tom's Prerogative right here on the Absolution Network. This is episode 133 of The Prerogative, and this time out, it's winter, it's cold, and yet things are heating up with love. So what would be perfect, more than anything, would be a tale that takes place during the winter that involves love and things like family and things, and what could be better than that, than a good old family animated film from America? And I got just the one that checks all the boxes in our list. It's in the winter, involves some form of love. And it's actually one of my favorite childhood films from the 90s. Ladies and gentlemen, today we are covering the third and final film as officially part of Amblin Entertainment, Balto, right here on Tom's Prerogative. Yes, Balto, the story, the legendary story of the sled dog who helped lead a sled dog team in the final leg of a relay that took place to deliver antitoxin to children in need of it in Nome, Alaska in 1925. Which sort of brings up a couple things that we're going to talk about really before we get into the review. But this is, again, it's one of those films that, like I said just a moment ago, that it's a favorite of my childhood. I fondly remember because, and as I mentioned, is a part of Amblin Entertainment. In fact, it's the third and final film officially a part of Amblin and Amblin. I can speak this word, I promise. Amblin Animation or Amblimation, because that you want the name of your company to be confusing to say. But this is Steven Spielberg's animation studio that he had formed. I don't want to say he offshoot from Domino, because, again, when you look at the history, which is really what I want to talk about, because we really haven't covered many Amblin entertainment products. I mean, you look at the history, eventually Amblin Animation, whatever you want to call it, and Amblin Entertainment kind of became DreamWorks. So it still existed, and so, you know, we kind of covered it. I don't know if we've ever officially covered any Kung Fu Panda or any How to Train Your Dragon or any DreamWorks stuff, actually, now that I think about it. I'll have to rectify that this year, because there's a lot of really good stuff. I love How to Train Your Dragon, both 1 and 2. I actually do enjoy the Kung Fu Panda series. As far as the movies, 3 was a little, I think, weak, but And two wasn't as good as the first, but the first one I really enjoy. And of course, Shrek, you know, again, I enjoy the first Shrek movie. They're really good CG realistic movies. Again, I'm about to go into talking about animation categorization again. But as far as sort of the Amblin, the hand-drawn animation, I think... Because it's sort of all combined with Don Bluth in a way, but not, because Don Bluth wasn't a part of this. But it was sort of started by partnerships with Steven Spielberg, George Lucas, and Don Bluth. Which, of course, Don Bluth had became a big name, in particular in the mid to late 80s, after Secret of NIMH was successful as part of his studio, and then that led to him... connecting with and partnering with Steven Spielberg and George Lucas, and that's when they came out with, you know, American Tail, which, again, you know, if you're a child in the 90s, how do you not know about Fievel and American Tail and American Tail 2, Fievel Goes West, which is the first movie officially of Amblin animation. By the way, the three movies were American Tail 2, Fievel Goes West, We're Back, A Dinosaur Story, which I actually have had been looking to maybe cover, because I've seen it. Like, one's like, oh, I remember this. I haven't seen it in a long time. And then the third one was Balto, which came out... Balto, which we're covering today, came out in 1995. But it was that partnership that created American Tail, created Land Before Time, which would go on to have, like, 15 more direct-to-video sequels. I actually honestly don't know, but it just seems like there's like a million direct-to-video sequels of The Land Before Time. But yeah, but these were sort of... Because you had Disney. Like, let's sort of establish, as a child with childhood G-rated or PG-rated animated movies, you had Disney, you know, and that was your Little Mermaid, your Beauty and the Beast. Warner Brothers really... I don't really remember Warner Brothers putting out that much. I think... I'm trying to think of what they put... Because I don't think they really put out that much. Because no one was really concerned animation. And I'm probably wrong about that, and I apologize. I just can't think of any... Like, I'm thinking in particular early 90s... Late 80s, early 90s to... Maybe mid-90s. And Warner Brothers really didn't do much animation. Like, a lot of it was Disney, because you had hand-drawn. Again, we're talking about 1995, and something to we'll mention in a second, the effect of Toy Story had on Balto, because they actually came out the same, I believe the same weekend. Let me double-check that as I'm talking. But that, and really, sort of the secondary animation was everybody else. And it was, like I said, it's Amblin Entertainment. It was, you know, Fievel. It was anything Don Bluth was working on. So you had things like Rock-a-Doodle-Doo, Thumbelina. I'm trying to think of... And it is. It is very hard. It's one of those things to where when you're doing research on it, it's like, oh yeah, I forgot all these movies were made in the late 80s, early 90s, because Disney, like, dominated everything about the animation scene, because they were just so, so good. So, we really, I don't think, had a real chance here on Tom's Prerogative to talk much about Amblin Entertainment. And like I said, I really enjoy all three of those films. I have fond memories of. I definitely have fond memories of both Fievel films, or at least... And I know there's a third film, we kind of don't mention that. it's okay, but I just remember both the first and second movie and loving both of them. In fact, if somebody... says woof, or something like that, I'll go woof. Bow wow. Bowie, wowie, bark, bark. Ha, ha, ha! Which, those might remember that's a sort of bit from, oh God, I'm blanking on the name of the character, which I do so much. But a great comedian, oh God, I'm sure people are going to yell at me, and I apologize. I'm probably going to end up looking it up now. Let's see, did it come out the same year as Toy Story? My notes are telling me, I know it was overshadowed by that, because it came out December 22nd. Let me see when Toy Story was released here, because live podcasting is awesome. It came out November 22nd, so it was the sort of the next animation film after that, which came out a month later, but, yeah, Toy Story was still going strong, so yeah, it was definitely, overshadowed by Toy Story's release. Because it really helps when you, like I said, live podcast now, but back to the story I was telling, because now I'm like completely, Dom DeLuise, God damn it. I should have remembered it, because you know what, folks, I hate it when I can't remember a name, because I care so much about these movies. Like, I should remember these names, but when you don't talk about these movies in such a long time, you forget names. But yeah, Dom DeLuise, who was Tiger. And there's the point in Five Goes West to where, you know, he has to become a dog. And, now that I think of it, I may have done Five Goes West. I don't know. I'll have to look it up. I've forgotten more than I know. Calming down now. I have to calm down. Yeah, but I have many memories of, you know, that. Of course, I also remember going to Universal and doing the Five O Goes West water ride there at Universal Studios Florida. It wasn't one of the things where you had to get into a bathing suit, but like at the sort of child program, they used to have a sort of Fievel playland, or at least one of the themes around the Fievel movies. And it was, I remember going after, of course, Five O Goes West. This was, I think, maybe 96, 97. And it was just like you got in a little inflatable tubi. One of those boat dinghies is actually the term. It's a dinghy. And you ride basically down this tube, and it takes you. It is a slide, so like if you, I guess if you fell out, no harm comes to you. You just go through water, but you stay in the dinghy, and you ride through the ride. Is it sad? That's what I remember most about the movie is Dom DeLuise's bark bark scene and the ride. I love the movie, I really do. But there that, I have fun memories of like the time I watched ages ago A Dinosaur Story. And like I said, I really, really love Balto. So I was very excited to get to review Balto and also to finally get a chance to talk about Amblin Entertainment. Because like I said, again, these three films, along with, you know, the partnership with Don Bluth for American Tail, you know, The Land Before Time, which, God, that's going to be forever in my mind. I remember getting both the DVD for Land Before Time and Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, like, in 1992, which, of course, had my favorite commercial of all time in it, which was on those VHS tapes. They had a Pizza Hut commercial. And it was the Right Field Pizza Hut commercial, the one where it's the kid who's playing in Right Field in a Little League game, and they're doing the whole Right Field, you know, the old song where, suddenly everyone's looking at me, I look all around to see what could it be, I look to the sky, and I raise my hand above, or however it goes, as a ball falls into my glove, I play right field. It's important to know. You gotta know how to catch. You gotta know how to throw. That's why I play in right field. Way out where the dandelions grow. Pizza Hut. Making it great. I can't even sing that song anymore, by the way, without saying Pizza Hut. Making it great. Because that's what stuck in my childhood. Because I was a huge fan of Pizza Hut. Still am. As any kid, though, was during that time. So, again, it's fun childhood memories. And, of course, I'm Jewish, for those who don't know. So, why wouldn't Five will be a fun story for me to enjoy and everything? But, yeah. Before, actually, we get into, again, review and everything proper, one more thing I kind of want to talk about. Is this is once again another case of a story based on a true story, as in it's based on a true story, but they take a lot of liberties. Now, there are a lot of people that criticize films like this and everything because they're not absolutely true with all the facts, and in facts are 100% correct. Because, you know, honestly, and I don't think it takes a rocket scientist to figure this out, the story of Balto isn't the story that's portrayed here. Balto wasn't a half-wolf, half-dog hybrid. He was a pure Siberian Husky, and he didn't even read, the last leg of the trip. He didn't actually do the most dangerous, which was done by another team, which was closer to Anna, but as the story goes, he got to the final checkpoint, and there was another team that was supposed to relay it from that checkpoint to Nome, but they were asleep, so they actually ended up doing two legs to get it to Nome on time, and that's part of what got him to be a hero. It's actually a very interesting read. I very much suggest you looking up the so-called 1925 Serum Run, which is the story of Balto, and, you know, what he did, what the other sled teams, and sort of the jealousy that led from these sled teams because of what the sort of the hero worship that Balto got, when some of it may have should have gone to some other teams who did equally great work. And it's a very, very fascinating read. But the thing I say, and I think I said this when I reviewed Pocahontas as well, and I say this for other stories, and I also say this for movies that tackle other cultures, because there have been, you know, I was reading some reviews, negative reviews of Moana. Or Mona. Mona, I think it's pronounced. And I apologize, because I really enjoyed the movie. I got to see it in December. And, yeah, I'm hoping to maybe review that this March, because it is scheduled to come out. And, of course, March, we do Disney. But, you know, and there's talks of, like, well, they didn't really work. I don't want to say truthful, but they accused them of not tackling, you know, the Polynesian religion the way they think they should have. But for all these films, I always say this, is that they shouldn't. And the reason I say that is what these films should be in that context is, hey, let's get these children interested in this, or in this culture, in this culture. And then the children, who will be naturally curious to want to learn more, will go out and learn more. You know, humans are very interesting creatures in that they're willing to learn. So these films are actually a lot more helpful than these people would give them credit for, in that it makes people more interested in the stories that they're telling. And so in that context, I actually don't have a problem with that. And I don't think a lot of people do. I really think it's just a complaint that stuck-up people make. And that sounds very, I think, dysnomic of me. Like, I'm just sweeping, like, you know, they can take any liberty they want. I do understand being worried about taking liberties for certain things. Sometimes that can really hurt a film. I'm not denying that. But I think in the long run, when you have good films like Balto, or Pocahontas, or in Mona, again, or Moana, excuse me, I'm going to be crucified regardless of which way I say that. I'm faintly remembered of Jim Ross during Wrestle Kingdom 9, you know, it's a double wrist lock. It's also known as Kimura. Regardless of what I call it, I'm going to be crucified. But Yeah, so in this sense, where it's a good movie, I don't have a problem with them taking liberties in certain parts here or there. As long as they make a good movie, and as long as it inspires people to want to learn more about the story. So this will be another story. As far as the liberties that this film takes, which I'm really not going to talk about much more than that, or what I'm talking about now, but I just wanted to put it out there. Like, I really don't have a problem as long as it gets people interested in the story and allows people then to go out and find the real story. I think in that sense, these movies do a lot more good to the story overall, the true story, because they make people interested in wanting to find out the real story. I know that's what it did for me as a kid, because I was always a curious kid, so when I liked something, I always looked more into it and read up more into it. And going into Balto, this is also why, as a kid, I liked this movie. Because before this movie came out, I actually knew the story of Balto. You know, I had read about, you know, the relay teams and everything. I had gotten a book that was basically on tragedies, tragedies and catastrophes, actually, and survival stories, which I think I was in third grade when I got the book. Which, you know, third grade, that's, I was about 8 years old. I think I was going to Ridgecrest Elementary School, in fact. I was either 8 and at Ridgecrest, or I was 9 when I got it, and I was at, not Morgan Fitzgerald, but, remember this. Robinson Challenge Elementary, which was a special 4 and 5th grade only elementary school that took like lots of field trips and was an absolutely awesome school. You know, when I look back at some of the teachers I had, I feel absolutely lucky that I've had some absolutely wonderful, wonderful teachers in my life. But I'm getting off track, actually. But I had gotten this book, and one of the stories told was, you know, this is the first attempt to say the name. I've been practicing, but the diphtheria, which was the sort of which is a bacterial infection, which is actually what hit the children in 1925 Nome. And so it had that story, and it told the story of the sled dog teams and how the people of Nome and of Alaska, like, worked really hard to get these antitoxin to Nome, which is, like, for those who don't know, Nome, Alaska, is, like, above the Arctic Circle, and it's, like, in northwest Alaska, above the Arctic Circle, as opposed to where Anchorage is, which is way below the Arctic Circle, like, towards the bottom southeast. So, I remember reading that story as a kid, so I was very, very excited to see Balto. And like I said, I ended up really loving it. I've always loved it. It's been actually one of my favorite sort of kids' animated films of the 90s. And today we get to review it. So let's get into it. So Balto starts with a grandmother and her granddaughter who are walking in Central Park in search for a memoriam. As they take a rest from the search, the grandmother tells her granddaughter the story of Balto, an abandoned half-dog, half-wolf hybrid that lives with a Russian goose named Boris and a couple of young polar bears named Muck and Luck in 1925 Nome, Alaska. When a rash of diphtheria hits the town and its children, especially, the town chooses a team of sled dogs led by the narcissistic sled dog and town hero, Steel, to retrieve the antitoxin that they are currently out of from Nyana, Alaska, which is 600 miles away. So you do the math, it ends up being a 12,000-mile trip there and back through the backwoods and deep snow-covered mountains of Alaska. But on the way back, the sled team gets lost, and now it's up to Balto to find and help lead the sled team back to Nome with the antitoxin and to save the children. It's a journey that may be too much for a dog, but just right for a wolf. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Balto.
Deep in the night, the winds blow cold, and in a heartbeat, the fear takes hold. Deep in a storm, there's a place that's soft and still, where the road waits to be taken, if you only will. The voices inside you can lead your soul astray. Believe in what you dream. Don't turn away, don't you turn.
And welcome back, and let's get right into music. And there's really no songs to talk about except for the end credits song, but we'll get to that in a second. So it is just mostly the score, which is done by James Horner, the legendary James Horner, which, I'll be quite honest, I didn't even realize had passed away in 2015. Like, that, I guess it like slipped under the radar to me. I didn't even realize that it happened. And it's... Especially after what 2016 was. But I just want to say, I find it sad that we lost him in 2015 to a plane accident. Obviously much too young to die at that age, or at his age. Because he's an absolutely fantastic and great composer. Like, when you think of the best and the greatest composers as far as in the movie industry, I mean, everybody thinks of John Williams and Danny Elfman, but, you know, and you have your Hans Zimmers who are up there, and so is James Horner. Like, those four in particular. Those are, like, as part in that top five. I actually don't know who the fifth person would be, actually. But, like, those are, like, sort of the four big ones that everybody knows. So, yeah, he did the score for this movie. Of course, he did scores for a lot of Amblin Entertainment projects, from Land Before Time and 5-0 Goes West, and among others. You know, in fact, I have the 5-0, the American Tale 1, the first movie. I have its soundtrack on my computer, in fact. Because never say never, say never again. I think I've sang enough for this episode, don't you think? But I probably will be singing again in a moment. But no, I absolutely love the score. You know, Horner, I think, has a really great feel for allowing music to be really atmospheric. And that's the real thing that keeps popping in my mind when I think about the score, is that it's really atmospheric. It really blends in well with the atmosphere. It's great attention. You know, when I think of, in particular, the piece of music that's used for, like, when they're overlooking the sick children, and sort of the reprieved use of the Reach for the Light song, which we'll be talking about, but you know, there are notes of that song that are used throughout the movie. It's a little repeat, you know, da, 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 da. And it's also part of the score that's used in sort of the final, where they succeeded at everything. And just, it really works well. The score just does a really great job, I think, of providing that atmosphere that blends in well with the movie, provides the atmosphere, the right atmosphere needed. You know, again, adds, lends, and helps the tension when tension is needed, and really much helps represent the sort of emotion that the movie is trying to portray for that current moment, whether it be sort of, like I said, the sadness overlooking the girls that are sick, and girls and boys, I should say, and all the other children who are sick, and sort of the dire needs that the town is in, to the jubilation that it feels when the sled team comes back and they've brought the antitoxin. So overall, I really, really do love and enjoy the score. I think it's very underrated. Obviously, people remember a lot of other scores. You know, I mentioned American Tail. You know, obviously, being that this film is 20 years old, they might remember more recent ones, like, you know, his score for Amazing Spider-Man. And, of course, he worked on Titanic, which... I'll be honest, I've never watched Titanic. Steve Harvey. I blanked on his first name first. Because I'm blanking over. When Steve Harvey in the Kings of Comedy said, "Did you sit through that long-ass movie?" Nope. I didn't sit through that long-ass movie. And no way am I sitting through that long-ass movie. And by the way, that's not me making fun of Steve Harvey. That's... because I just love saying long-ass, because it's the perfect way to describe Titanic. It's a long-ass movie. which is supposed to be James Cameron's sort of epic, you know, telling of the tragedy of the Titanic with these great special effects. The special effects are great, where it shows the actual destruction of the Titanic. And what does everybody remember about that movie? They remember a hand on a steamy glass. That's supposedly the greatest sex ever shown in cinema. It's why I have questions about the human race. Seriously, I do. But, like, people remember that, so they might not remember this score that he did, and I think it's one of his more underrated scores as far as what he's done. So, and that does sort of... well, it really doesn't, but, you know, as I made mention, throughout the score, there are reprises and instrumental uses of sort of what would be the end credit song, which is called Reach for the Light, which is performed by Steve Winwood. That's for you youngins, that's an 80s musician. 80s, late, obviously, early 90s. I think he got his start in the 80s and was still popular in the early 90s. And I think, again, he's sort of that, it's not a genre, but it's like when you think of sort of certain 90s artists, when you think of Michael Bolton, you think of Steve Wood in sort of that same category as like Michael Bolton, Kenny G. Like, there's these group of like artists of all different genres that we sort of, that are like, part of easy listening. Like, when we make easy 90s easy listening playlists, like, all these artists are in there. And I'll be quite honest, I don't know much more about Steve Winwood more than this. I mean, I've heard other songs he's done, and I know he's done more in his career. And maybe I shouldn't have been more focused on James Horner in this case, but you know, back on track. I absolutely loved this song. I love this song. Whenever I'm down and I sort of feel alone, I actually put this song on and play it, because it's such a beautiful sort of hopeful song. I love the melody. It's bigger than notes at the beginning. The way that beginning goes, da 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 da, da 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 da, and then sort of the wind, as if the wind sort of bringing the song in, and it goes deep in the night, Da 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 da. Da 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 da. And sort of that, the way, in particular, the first two verses uses that sort of, it's portrays sort of a sense of darkness in the song and everything. And then it gets to the chorus, which is then pops up and is much more bright and hopeful. And it really shines through the most at the end, where they sort of come back from sort of the bridge and the instrumental part, and the children come and go, "Reach for the night to capture a star down the mountain top and see yourself flying." And I'm probably going to get people. Yeah, I was just actually listening to the song before the podcast. I should remember. But then you forget a lot of stuff when you go on a rant and ramble about Amblin animation. I think you could tell I really do love this song. I love the melody. I love the hopefulness of it. I love sort of the contrast between the verse and the chorus, and how they play off each other so perfectly. And like I said, I love listening to this song. It's part of my easy listening playlist. It's a very hopeful song. It's like right up there with I'm trying to remember the name. I Believe in You, which you might remember as sort of that opening song of Big Green, which was the live action Disney soccer film that starred the guy from Police Academy. And I'm completely blanking on names here, and I'm not going to focus on that because that's not important right now. Not that the actors are not important, but, and I do care about the movie, but we need to move on. Let's move on to animation. I actually really love the overall style. You know, again, Amblin Entertainment, in particular the hand-drawn division here with things like American Tail and Balto, you saw with Dinosaur Story as well, is their style is a bit more subdued. I actually think a lot more earthy colors in this case. They're not as big as Disney, and they didn't have sort of the great power that Disney did. But what they did have was soul. And the thing is that in the overall style of Amblin Entertainment is that there's a lot of soul. You know, through the backgrounds, the special effects we're going to get into, the character designs, you know, there's this instance where they're colored, but they almost come off as sort of, you can see the sketch drawings underneath in a way, but it actually lends itself to the real soul of the movie. And please ignore the sounds coming from behind the curtain. But yeah, there's just such soul in the drawings and in the art overall, and it just brings you really into the movie and makes you really feel in depth in the movie. So I really much love the overall style of, as I get distracted, I love the overall style of Amblin Entertainment, and in particular with this movie, because like they're just such soul. They're earthy tones, because there's a lot of white in this movie, and they bring a lot of color to a world that is just covered in white, with the use of earthy tones, and just they do. I think they also do a really great job with contrast in this film. I think a real particular scene that shows this is the grizzly bear scene. By the way, grizzly bear, before I forget, voiced by Frank Wickler. Because when we need an animal in a movie, let's get Frank instead of a live animal. Because Frank takes direction better. As coded by Scott McNeil. Or quasi-coded. He didn't say it exact that way. But, yeah. Mind you, we had two Transformer cast members in this movie. Because you had Frank Wickler here, and then you had Jack Angel, who played one of the three sort of sidekick dogs to steal. I believe it's the one who gets bopped on the head all the time. Again, we'll get into all that comedy in a little bit. But that grizzly bear attack scene, to where there's a lot of... The grizzly bear is portrayed in very dark colors, almost black colors. And so there's a lot of black and white there. Well, we're going to get to that in a second with Steel and character design. But again, and then the trees are presented very dark, but you have the characters, the protagonists presented in light colors. And there's white there, and it helps create a very tense atmosphere for, you know, the viewer to watch. And again, a lot of dark... And again, it's really that contrast of darkness and using portraying the white snow in sort of a dark manner, but then portraying it in a light manner, sort of representing hope. And there's a very much good, like I said, contrast, really good use of white and black here. And there's sort of a theme within the animation. What a shock here. The actual animation itself and the actual art helping to tell the story. And again, here it's what's being told, reach for the light, sort of the hope, the light in the darkness. It is really a overall theme being portrayed throughout the animation, throughout the art, throughout the movie. And a perfect example of this, again, because I made mention, or quasi made mention to it during the bear attack scene, was Steel. As we go into character designs, Steel being black and white, you can only see things in a black or white matter, which leads to his narcissism. There's a connection with character there, as opposed to characters like Jenna and Balto, which are more colored, and therefore, they're able to see beyond, they're able to see the different shades of things. So I like how the character design lends itself to that. And there's also a thing with Steel to where, again, that white is underneath him, so he's mostly black, so he's in a way that he's trapped in the darkness in such a way. It is, I think, a very clever thing that they do with that character design as well. And going to Balto, I really love his design. Like how they blend sort of wolf and dog design there to where he's clearly a dog, but you see elements of wolf in him, and you can see how he's very much different from the other dogs. I don't want to call him a mutt, but they give him an appearance of a dog that doesn't have a home, that doesn't get to have a good meal every day. And that's just, I really enjoy it. Actually, probably my favorite character design is Boris. Because, again, it's sort of character, it actually reminds me, the Russian guy on Arrow, the friend of Ollie, who's no longer a friend, but now a friend again, and first met on the island, and, very funny guy. Boris reminds me of Boris in a way. It's like this sort of very round, happy, fun Russian, who plays the mentor character in this case. But yeah, I just love sort of the roundness of Boris. And of course, it's a bird. It's a bird in the animation. And when in doubt, hurt the bird. I guess we'll get to comedy. But no, just in general, I love all the character designs. I think all of them, the color schemes work within each character, sort of tell each character's story, or at least help tell each character's story. Sort of the brown is sort of the representing brown and grayness of Balto's color. That's sort of representing the in-betweenness of black and white. Jenna being the very warm red color, or maroon, sort of a representation not a pure love, but a sort of undying love. I think that works well there. Again, you have polar bears. Polar bears are going to be white, but again, like one has a black nose, one has a red nose. Used for help differentiating them besides size. And then the size of Muck and Luck. I really like, you know, the big one being, you know, not completely able to speak. It's sort of like in huffs and everything. And then, of course, you have the smaller one transferring for him and everything. I really enjoyed the character designs. I thought all of them were really good. And I think they lent themselves well to the story. But bar none, the showstopper and the one that stole the show for this movie was the special effects. I think the special effects are really outstanding. The uses of snow and ice effects and everything. And, like, I know when I still talk to people, I say, well, I think Frozen would have been better if it was an animated movie. It's like, oh, no, they couldn't have done those things if it was hand-drawn. Well, guess what? Balto's the movie I point to when people say that, because the special effects in this movie are just absolutely outstanding. Amazing work with the snow and the ice effects and everything, and just even more so than the background. And the backgrounds are beautiful, but you become emboldened and in-depth into this world that they present to you. Which one is my favorite? You know, in particular during sort of the final act where Balto reaches the snow dogs and he's trying to lead them home. You know, you have the scene to where Steel has, you know, messed up his markings, and he goes out and Balto leads the team down the wrong path, and they're on the edge of that cliff, which Balto ends up falling down with the antitoxin. And there's the point to where he's lost in the snow, and you have the snow blowing all around, and the white wolf comes out and tries to howl with him. It's that moment to where he realizes and sort of accepts his inner wolf. And just the way the snow is howling, and it's like this sort of one spot that sort of becomes like its own world. The special effects are so well done. It's a great example of that. Another, to me, great example is the ice cave, which had some great movie. I'm now thinking of the E.T. thing, to where one of the dogs goes into this glass and he all of a sudden looks like E.T. Because we need Easter eggs. But just the way the ice glistens and reflects and everything, it's so well done. I've seen people give some bad reviews about this movie, about it's like the animation isn't the stuff. But then again, I also don't think people are really paying attention to the animation, because in particular the special effects are just absolutely outstanding. The snow and ice effects are outstanding. And I think the overall, again, the style is atmospheric. It's more subdued than Disney. It definitely is. And if you're used to Disney, it can be jarring. But I think it's just as good as Disney here, or anything Disney would do at this time. Maybe not as good as Beauty and the Beast. But, like, it's much better than their direct-to-DVD sequels. Which really isn't saying much, actually. I mean, yes, truth be told, Disney is still miles ahead. But there's a lot of soul in this animation. And sort of to compare this to Disney animation really isn't fair. It's like trying to compare a really good small independent wrestling company to WWE. It's not a fair thing to compare to. And just overall, I think the animation is really, really good. So, with that, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to get into acting, and we are going to get into the story. So, I'll be right back, folks. After these messages, we'll be right back.
Saturday Morning Fever, the new show from the Fire & Water Podcast Network celebrating the classic Saturday morning cartoons. Available on fireandwaterpodcast.com, iTunes, and Stitcher. Saturday Morning
Fever. Batman Nightcast, a thrilling new podcast from the Fire & Water Podcast Network. Hosted by Ryan Daly
and Chris Franklin, Nightcast chronicles the Caped Crusaders' adventures in Batman and Detective Comics after Crisis on Infinite Earths.
Highlights from this legendary era include
Batman number 400,
Legends,
Mike Barr and Alan Davis,
Batman Year 1,
Batman Year 2,
Max Allen Collins, the new Jason Todd, Millennium?
You're not doing this right. Let me take over. Alan Grant and Norm Breyfogle.
Alan Grant from Jurassic Park?
Did you hear me say Norm freaking Breyfogle?
Oh, yeah.
Son of the Demon.
The Killing Joke.
A Death in the Family.
Batman Year 3.
A Lonely Place of Dying.
Alan Grant, Alan Davis, Max Allen Collins. Why are there so many people named Alan from this era of Batman?
The Rise of Tim Drake.
Legends of the Dark Knight.
And that's just up until 1989.
Did anything exciting happen with Batman after that?
You'll have to tune in to find out.
Batman Nightcast, part of the Fire & Water Podcast Network.
Find it on iTunes and at fireandwaterpodcast.com.
Oh, we forgot to mention your favorite issue, when Batman fires Dick Grayson.
You want to find another co-host?
And welcome back, and it is time to cover acting, which means it's time to go over our cast list. Kevin Bacon plays Balto. Bob Hoskins, one of our favorites here at the Absolution Network, plays Boris. Bridget Fonda voices Jenna. Phil Collins as Muck and Luck. Jim Cummings, the legendary Jim Cummings, as Steel. Juliette Brewer voices a young Rosie. And in the live-action scenes, Miriam Margolyes, I apologize for mispronouncing that name. Margolyes, I believe is how it's pronounced. And I'm probably going to be crucified either way. Again, for like the 60 millionth time. But she does the live-action Rosie, the grandmother. Pretty sure, again, that's not a spoiler warning, though. As with any of these movies, spoiler warning, but that should be obvious. Jack Angel as Nikki, Danny Mann as Kaltag, Robbie Rice as Star. Those are the sort of the three psychic characters that are Foul Steel that are part of the team. And Sandra Dixon as Dixie, a purple Pomeranian. Excuse me, and Sylvie, another I'm blanking on the name of the breed. I apologize. But it's another sort of different dog breed. That's your cast. And I have a lot to love with this cast. I personally love the voice work in this film. I know other people haven't enjoyed it. And, you know, again, one thing I do when I, you know, start doing research for the films and stuff that I review is I do try to look at other reviews. And I do try to look at, like, what other people have said. And the reason is, I do want to, you know, if this is what people are commonly saying about it, I want to tackle that as one of the questions. Like, is this really something that people are seeing, or what's going on? Not, again, not that people can have the opinion that they have, but, you know, as I think I've talked about before, there is always an instance that's, why a film doesn't work sometimes involves with a cultural misunderstanding or something here, or something there. And a lot of times, sometimes you find that that misunderstanding about the film isn't fair. And it's like, I know we've had many times on this show to where we've said, like, if you look at it this way, like, it's really good. And in fact, particularly with acting, and sometimes people just don't like other people's performances, and that's okay, but here, I really, really love the performances. I love that Kevin Bacon is a bit subdued. Like, he's not Kevin Bacon. Like, those who've seen Kevin Bacon know Kevin Bacon can be Kevin Bacon. But here, he's not Kevin Bacon. I think he actually subdues himself, and he does a really great job of portraying himself here as Balto. And it allows yourself to believe in the character. And I think his voice range actually really works well for what you want for this hero character to have in this story in particular. Bob Hoskins just, like, oh, God, nails it as Boris. Of course, y'all know Bob Hoskins for many things. You know him, of course, as from Who Framed Roger Rabbit. You know him from Hook, you know, Snee. you know him, he's had such a great career. Actually, one of my favorite movies that he's did that I don't think it's enough respect is, oh God, what's the name of the movie? I'm blanking on the movie. But it's the Jet Li movie where, you know, he supposedly raised Jet Li to be this psychopathic brawler, and then Jet Li rebels against him, and he's like British mobster. It's a really good movie. Once again, I'm blanking on the name of the movie. It's like got one word. It also stars Morgan Freeman. I really actually have to go and get it now. I really do. That has to be on my list. But I'm not just saying I like Bob Hoskins in this role because I like Bob Hoskins. He really does a really good job as sort of the comedy relief. There's a very sort of Abbott and Costello feel here between Balto and Boris. And both Kevin Bacon and Bob Hoskins work really well off each other. You know, with Balto being sort of straight man, Boris being the other. And then I actually like Phil Collins. I think they do a good enough job as Muck and Luck. They're very funny. They're very memorable and enjoyable. Of course, their shining moment in this film is, you know, where they don't think twice. Earlier in the film, they complain, I can't swim. And it's like, Bob Hoskins is like, hey, boys, maybe you would, if it wasn't high tide. And just a little shake of the web fins there. It's like, God damn it. But, there's shining moments. You don't think twice to see Balto when Balto gets trapped underneath ice in a lake. And they go and they swim. And of course, like we said, the president has been stated earlier in the film that they say that we can't swim. And they, without even knowing it, swim and rescue Balto. And Balto makes like, you know, one day somebody's going to have to teach you boys to swim. I think you'd be really good at it. And then I think it's Luck who goes, like he's got this sort of beeper. Again, as I mentioned, like, only runs, it's like grunts and sounds like that. And then, like, Muck will, then Phil Collins will then actually talk as Muck, translating like, well, of course he knows, of course. I mean, we were under the water, we were moving, we were like, we can swim. And it's like that, it's just a very genuine, funny moment. I think Phil Collins nailed, like, that joke, if not said the right way with the same amount of enthusiasm and such, the joke could fall flat. But the way he, I'm about to say develop, but delivers that joke makes the joke work. And it's a genuine funny moment at a time where, again, they were providing a little bit of comedy after a very dark moment. And again, it's that give and take with this film that I actually really, really like. Bridget Fonda, I think, brings a good amount of warmth to Jenna's character. I sort of mentioned, more family, her color, Maroonstrom, I think, represented more family love than outright love, which would have meant a more pronounced red coat. But also, when you look at warm, it's a warming color. You know, red is a very warm color. And again, with her voice, she provides, I think, a lot of warmth to Jenna, a lot of caring and warmth. I think the line that really nailed it for me is very early on in the film, or not very early on, but it's after Jenna and Balto had been underneath the doctor's office and had been caught by Steele and everything, and they're having the race to see which dogs will be on the sled team to go get the antitoxin. And Sylvie's like, you know, I heard from a very reliable... Which, by the way, apparently, outside of Jenna, all the other girl dogs in Nome, Alaska talk like they're from they're Jewish girls from New York, or Jewish old aunts from New York. He's like, no, I heard from a very reliable source, so don't even deny it, that you were, well, swooping around with Balto. That Brooklyn girl. Trust me, I have Jewish aunts that talk exactly like this. I know what I'm talking about, even if I can't do the impression. but there's a point where she looks like, okay, so I won't. It's like, I'm speechless. Or Sylvie says, I'm speechless. And it's a great little joke there, a little comedy, but it's like, the way she delivered that line, would, like, yeah, okay. I'm not going to deny it. It's like, that's where it really clicked. I'm like, yes, yeah, she really has got this character, like, nailed. And in all the rest of the characters, you know, I think just overall, great voice cast. Jim Cummings, because before I get, let me gush about Jim Cummings. It's like, again, like I said, I am gushing about these actors because I am fans of all these actors. I'm not as much of a fan maybe of Bridget Fonda because I haven't watched many movies with her, though I am a fan of her in Kiss of the Dragon with Jet Li. Again, two Jet Li movie references in one film. Not in the film, but in one review. Because I love myself some Jet Li, and Kiss of the Dragon is also, I think, a very underrated Jet Li film as well. It's got a great sort of, by the way, in that film, there's a great a remix of a Daft Punk song. In particular, the song in question is Aerodynamic. It's like Slum in the Hills or something. It's really good remix song, and it's used during a fight scene that I really much enjoy. And there's a lot of great fight scenes in that movie, from where Jet Li takes on an entire room of French police training in karate. That's a really good scene. A very underrated movie, as in the other Jet Li movie I was thinking about. But back on a point, I'm not just gushing about these actors because I like them. As I said, I think what they do in this movie is really good. And Jim Cummings is like, again, on our Mount Rushmore of voice actors, Jim Cummings is there, along with Scott McNeil and Frank Wicker and others. And I'm going to stop now before I blink on any more names. But, yeah, just, again, that narcissistic attitude that's like just so embedded in the character. And the shining moment for Jim Cummings' performance here is when Balto finds the sled dog team and he's trying to help, and it's just like, Steele talks very little, here you have Balto, this supposed half-dog, half-wolf hybrid that can't be trusted, who's very calm and collected and just trying to talk things, and here's Steele, this so-called town hero, as he's been portrayed throughout the movie, and, Jim Cummings is like breathing hard and everything, and just portraying Steele as this just rabid beast. That's like, he doesn't care if everybody dies. He's going to do it his way. He's going to be the hero and he's going to get all the attention. And that narcissism really shining through. God, he just plays villains so great. So I thought he did a really great job portraying Steele in that villain role. One more thing I want to make mention. This is not a voice cast, but again, as I made mention, the grandmother, as it turns out, is Rosie. And the grandmother is actually played by Miriam, like I said, Margolyes, who I was very shocked to find her history. Again, there's a Harry Potter connection here. She played Professor Sprout in the Harry Potter is a long line of adventure books that teaches young kids how to go to potty. The Harry Potter books, or I should say the Harry Potter movies that she has been in. And she's actually been in a lot of stuff. She's even dubbed some early anime. Apparently there's a series called Monkeys from Japan that she dubbed. And I don't think it's the 12 Monkey series that was on like ABC Kids in the mid-thousands. It's like right around the time they had Power Rangers The Lost Galaxy and Power Rangers Lightspeed Rescue. I saw her filmography and like, damn, this woman's amazing. But yeah, I just felt like it's the Harry Potter love there. There's a lot of good actors that were a part of this film. So overall, I actually really enjoy the acting. I think it's really good. I think there are just several key performances that really, really help the movie along, from like Bob Hoskins and Jim Cummings. Kevin Bacon, I think, really captures the spirit of what Balto is supposed to be. And his subduedness is actually works, I think, for the character. Bridget Fonda brings a really good warmth to the character of Jenna. And Phil Collins really, really does well in that sort of comedy relief role. And so overall, I just think that the whole cast really does a great job in the film. But with that, let's move on to our final segment, story. So, as I say, take a swig of some vitamin C. Sunny Delight. The only thing that I can seem to find is substitute soda. At least I'm getting my vitamin C intake for the year. Where was I? I got lost. Story. Live podcasting is awesome. And I will keep making that joke till the day I die because I don't want to cry. The very first thing I actually want to talk about with story is the ultimate theme of the story. Because the plot is very simple, and we're going to talk about the plot because in keeping it simple actually I think works for the film. But then there's the theme that works alongside it that they're trying to tell. Because again, they are telling a true story, but they're trying to use this true story to tell a sort of morality tale. And in this case, the morality tale being told here is of acceptance. Being in acceptance and being of who you are and being proud of who you are. You know, they really nail throughout this movie, again, because it's all about, again, Balto being the main character. And his story is a journey of acceptance of his wolf side. Again, him being a half-dog, half-wolf hybrid. It's really same, genuine family, different species, crossbreed, you know. I'm not going to get into bird and beach science here, but I think everybody gets what I'm trying to say. Awkward, move away from this. Move away now. But, again, he has to accept that wolf side of him. And it's only once he accepts that wolf side that he's able to, you know, get the antitoxin back up the mountain to the dog team. And they're able to get it to Gnome. And again, that story of acceptance is really built really, really well throughout the movie. At the beginning, he really wants to be a sled dog. He wants to be a sled dog. He wants to be a dog. He wants to be a dog. And that leads him well all the way up until they get lost after sort of Steel betrays them and ruins all the markings. And like, then there's that really great scene. And it really is one of the shiny moments and one of the key moments of the movie where, again, as I may mention before, the scene to where it's sort of like they're in their own little world and it's Balto and this white wolf and they're howling together. And it's that him finally accepting his wolf half and being proud of it and using it to help the team. You know, that story and the way that theme is built throughout the movie really, really gives the movie a heart and soul that I think you can connect to. And yes, is it very easy to see and understand what the theme is? Absolutely. But just because something is easy to see or easy to understand doesn't mean it's bad. I mean, it's not like it's Batman Begins where it beats you over the head with a freaking sledgehammer about how everything is about fear. I mean, literally, damn. But here, again, and in mind you, they don't talk about acceptance, accept who you are. It's like, but again, the way Boris, you know, and they interact and everything, it builds up to that. And then when you combine that with just, again, this is sort of a simple telling of a story. And again, using a true story as the basis of fact. The kids come down with this infection. They're out of antitoxin. They have to get in a certain number of days. There's a race against time element. Though they, I think one of the things they smartly do in the film is they never really say how much time before it's too late for the kids. And so, like, you feel tension, like, there's no time limit. They could die at any moment. They need to get here now. And so that lends itself to the tension in that regards of the story. And he, again, the story of going, getting the antitoxin, facing the elements, battling the elements to get to Gnome. There's a natural tension. Again, being only showing, mind you, that kids were affected was also, I think, really smart because, again, and this is one of the, I think, the ways where you take a true story and take liberties in a right way, in that they only showed children. The actual thing that hit, I know it helped hit mostly children, but there were also some adults, but they focused on mostly how it affected children because, again, let's be honest, most people, even if it isn't their child, care deeply about children and don't want to see innocent children hurt. It's just normal human behavior. And so I think it was really well for them to play off that sort of deep emotion that we all have and lend itself to the natural tension that the story provides. And like I said, you then add that to that theme of being proud of who you are and acceptance as part of Balto and lend itself that the success of the plot hinges on Balto completing his journey of acceptance of who he is. Both the plot and the theme work really well intertwining themselves with each other and bouncing off each other and really helping push each other forward. You know, the plot pushes the theme, which pushes the plot, which pushes the theme, and it's back and forth, and it's really well done. And at no point do I feel the theme overpowers the story, nor do I, or the plot, nor do I feel the story and the plot overpower the theme. Or to put it in a more better term, the story is the theme and the plot together. And they work really well. And what becomes its strength is sort of the third point, which is they really build all the characters well. It's why I gush about the voice acting and like the character designs as much as I did, because those were sort of the enhancements that really helped, that they took their time in the beginning to build and introduce you to all these characters and make you fall in love with them. You know, you fall in love with sort of the rascalian sort of attitude of Balto. Boris makes you laugh, and as with any character, if a character makes you laugh, or says you laugh, because laughed is not a word, but if a character makes you laugh, you know, you start to find yourself falling in love with them. And there's a lot of genuine laughs that Boris brings. Like I said, the warm and caringness of Jenna and Rosie. They did focus on the kids, but they really focused on Rosie and the pain she was going through. And while you would generally be concerned because, you know, she's a kid, when they show her in the very beginning of the film, from when you first see her, and you see this kid who is absolutely in love with her gift. And I just mean absolutely in love. To where she's, you know, it's like, here's your gift. You can open your eyes, and it's a sled. She goes, and she can't speak for a second. And that just absolute pure, unadulterated joy that you see on this child's face, which, by the way, the joke that I really love, it's like where she hooks up to Jenna and like, mush, and yeah, I love my sleigh, and it's like, I don't know, maybe we should have gotten her the dollhouse, he says sarcastically, much like, I think she'll be alright. which then lets itself to where her hat gets blown into the, again, it's that very classic sort of, oh, here's how we make the hero look like a great person and the villain look like an absolute douche. You know, here's his hat that gets blown and he's not going to slow down. And the hero has to race to just save the hat. And there's that very funny moment. It's like, no, thank you, Balto. And like, she's the only one that's willing to show love to Balto. By the way, I just love that apparently the entire town just has no problem with the notion that their dogs like other dogs. It's like, you did, because Rosie does that whole thing, like, in doing it all to oppress Jenna. And it's like, how old are you, honey? And did your dad and mommy teach you the birds and bees already? Because if they did, well, their prerogative, but I need an adult. I don't want to think about the 1925 bird and bee talk to a young, like, little 8-year-old girl. I just don't, because it's very creepy for some reason to me. But yeah, but that acceptance where she's like the only one who accepts Balto and cares about Balto. And while all the other town people in the town, including her father and her mother, are like shooshing him away. You know, because he's the mutt that lives on the outside of town. It's amazing he's survived this long. And like, she's the only one who shows that affection. And that immediately connects you with her as a good person. So when you see her suffer, you know, it really heightens how much you care about what happens to this character. And it's the same thing for all the other characters. Again, we talked about how they built Balto, how they built Jenna, Boris, and Muck and Luck in their forms of comedy relief. Boris also sort of being the mentor character during Balto's journey, providing sort of insight and motivation for him. Building Steel up, you know, I kept thinking, like, this is a very Gaston-type character. He's a narcissist who, again, the entire town adores him. But unlike, you know, Beauty and the Beast, where Gaston falls to his death, and you would have to imagine the town still loves Gaston. There's probably a statue of him, like, Gaston, who lost his life in the heroic raid of the Beast's castle. You'd have to imagine there's a statue in Belle's old town for Gaston. But here, he's the town here, and it's that great comeuppance moment to where, you know, when they get back and everybody realizes Steel has been lying to them, and just the perfect comeuppance to where he's just abandoned. And it's you had Balto at the beginning who's abandoned by everybody except Boris Muffinlock, who's his family, and to an extent Jenna and Rosie. And Steel has everything. And then at the end of the film, it's Steel who ends up abandoned by everybody, and Balto, who now has this new town, or has the love of the town upon him, which he rightfully deserves for what he did. So again, just the way they built the characters, in particular at the beginning, it became the core strength of the film, and it's really, again, the sort of the glue that really helped intertwine the story and the theme, the overall theme of the movie, together as one, and really made it that enjoyable. And then we have the comedy. I love this movie in so many ways for its comedy. It's genuine funny. And that's the thing I keep thinking. It's like, there are bits, and you see these sort of bits in other movies, but it's just genuine funny. And it makes you laugh. Muck and Luck, as I may mention, again, their shiny moment in the lake, and that sort of, the way that punchline is delivered perfectly. Boris, obviously, they're taking lessons from the John Musker and Ron Clements school of animation storytelling to, when in doubt, hit the bird. But they don't overdo it with sort of the violence. I mean, in that sense, the most violence any of the comedy gets is at the beginning, where you have sort of the Sebastian moment, where Boris, his head is on the chopping block and gets saved only in the nick of time by Balto. Yeah, and the comedy really lends itself well in that it provides the right amount of lightheartedness at the right time. It's not just like, oh, here's this lighthearted comedy at any moment. No, they do it at the right time when it's needed to sort of lighten the story up just a bit, to not let it get too dark before the right moment. Because the right moment, which is what they do really well, is they make the movie the darkest when Balto falls down, falls off the mountain. And it's like the darkest before dawn theory, to where you have that very, that's the darkest moment of the movie. And then Balto reaches for the light. Again, I'm connecting everything here. And so what kept it from being, are getting too dark early on, is again all those little comedy bits, taking little moments here and there to provide a little comedy, a little lightheartedness that really helped the story along. If there's one criticism I have of the story, it's the pacing. And I think the first part paced wonderfully, second part paced wonderfully. This movie, by the way, is about an hour and 18 minutes with credits. So, with the credits, I think, being like about 3 minutes, or maybe a little under 3 minutes long. I'd say it's around an hour 14, hour 13. And again, most of it is a lot of people subscribe to the idea that, in particular, a child's animation can't be longer than 90 minutes. But with that being said, again, if it's 90 minutes, that's an hour and a half. So, I think this film could have used about 10 to 15 more minutes. And they could have used that, I think, in the third act to maybe portray some more. Because the one thing is that I feel like the third act is a bit too fast. Like, they could have taken a bit more time. Like, the first part of the stuff done and the mountain part is done. Really, it's that scene that starts where they're going over the ice bridge that breaks, which ultimately leads to the avalanche. And I think the place that they could have probably put some more time could have been the ice caves. Now, I think you could have put some more time there. They could have put some more time during the montages of like what's going on and where they're traveling. Now that I actually think about it, and it's like something, you know, when you do these notes, you're like, you're in a certain mindset. But now that I think about it more, it's like there's probably not that much time you could have put into what it is before the scenes became too long. But I just feel like they could have given at least a little bit more time, maybe told a little bit more story in the ice caves, a little bit more story on the mountain passes. Because the third act feels real, not really rushed, but a bit rushed. It doesn't hurt the film by any means, as you've heard me talk about, but yeah, it's just that third act feels a bit rushed for my taste. So that's overall my review. So what do I rate this movie? Well, overall, I think Balto is a wonderful, wonderful animated movie from the 90s. There's a reason it's developed such a cult following, even though it may have not done well in the theaters because, again, Toy Story. You know, not many things are going to beat Toy Story in the theater. Not really anything I can think of, but with the home video release and everything, more people have seen it, more people can enjoy it. And, you know, it's just a fun, lighthearted, warm, enjoyable movie with a lot of great lighthearted characters who are built in a very natural, organic way that you just connect with and you care. Like, seriously, I watch this movie and there are scenes to where I tear up because they've connected with me and I'm so connected with the characters. And it hurts to see Rosie, suffering. Yeah, I know she's a fictional character, but I'm brought so into the movie that I come to the verge of crying because it's so sad what's happening to her. And there's a very exulting joy when Balto makes it and they save the children. And it's just like, this is such a great movie. It's a movie that can be enjoyed by anybody. It may be made for kids, but they did a wonderful job making this movie that anybody and everybody can enjoy. It's Balto, I think, is one of the most underrated animated movies ever because it's so good. The score, the atmosphere, everything is really well done. The acting, for the most part, is superb. There's not an awful or bad performance, even if in the movie at all. And I was about to say, even if you don't like Kevin Bacon, he does a well enough job here It's like there's no bad performances in this movie. The animation is wonderful, and it's that different feel from Disney that we need. And yeah, Balto is an absolutely wonderful movie. I give Balto 5 out of 5 stars. I think it's a must-have for any animation fan. And I think any family will enjoy watching it. So, Balto gets a 5 out of 5 from me. And that is it for this episode of Tom's Prerogative. I hope you enjoyed my show today. Again, like I said, with Tom's Prerogative, I'm on a as-I-can-do-it schedule. So, I can't completely give you when my next episode is going to come out. I don't know if I'm going to get one out again in February. So, which means I'm probably not going to get another one out till March. Which means, March means Disney month. So, probably the next episode will feature, I don't know which Disney film yet. I'm looking at a lot. Like I said, I'm looking at Moana probably towards the end of the month. Yeah, I'm looking at several Disney movies trying to decide which ones are going to make this year's Disney month, because it's like, this is definitely a month I look forward to doing, because I love reviewing Disney movies. So next episode is probably going to be something Disney related. Remember to, send email at absolutionnetwork132@gmail.com. Remember to check the network out at www.an.132productions.com. And thank you for all and continued support. Please send any email or any comments you want, because I want to know how I'm doing. I want to know what I'm doing, and I want to know how I'm doing, because sometimes I don't know what I'm doing. But that's it for this episode of Tom's Prerogative. And until next time, my Toonami generation.
Find cover. It's gonna get too dangerous.
Stay gold.
Hope you enjoyed it. This is Tom signing off. And until we meet again, you know the rest.